But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show, where we discuss the key topics shaping the UK wealth management industry and investors' portfolios. I'm Sophie Downes, and I'm joined today by Peter McLean, Head of Multi-Asset Portfolio Solutions at Stonehage Fleming. Welcome to the podcast, Peter.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start right in the thick of it. We're continuing to see tensions with Iran rippling through the markets. From a multi-asset perspective, what would you say is the biggest economic risk of this conflict?
Well, it's clearly an extremely uncertain period, a huge amount of volatility that we're experiencing within energy markets, equity markets, and bond markets. First and foremost for us, the important thing is to put it in context of longer-term investment objectives. And the reason for doing that is it helps us stay the course, keep calm, and ensure that we don't rebalance portfolios into severe periods of market volatility, but also look for opportunities to identify areas into which to rebalance portfolios and take advantage of any dislocations that occur. Now, in the context of the bigger economic risks that could come out of this, I think clearly the immediate one is the inflation consequences of higher energy prices. Now, a lot depends here on the duration of the conflict, which at this point is very difficult to anticipate. But the inflation impact is likely to feed through, particularly for European economies, the UK as well, who are more reliant on imported natural gas and oil, where, of course, prices have spiked quite considerably. It's less severe for the US economy, but certainly there is an element of an inflationary pickup that we could expect to see in the coming months.
Mm-hmm. And how are you assessing those risk premiums? So we've spoken a little bit about inflation, and I know you've written about the energy prices. Is there a particular figure or metric you're watching closely to see whether it's apt to go in and rebalance?
Yeah, I think the key thing to watch here is inflation expectations. So it's worth just looking back at 2022, when we last saw a similar period of course, heightened geopolitical stress when Russia invaded Ukraine. And in that during that period, inflation was already rising quite meaningfully, and we had a large number of dislocations within the labor market, within broader supply chains, which meant that inflation expectations were already quite high. So the difference today is that those inflation expectations are quite well anchored. In fact, we've seen them falling over the past 6 months or so, since some of the tariff-related uncertainty has been fading. And also, the labor market is a lot weaker than it was back in 2022. Job openings are much lower. Unemployment has actually been rising. So the key thing that we've been watching over the past week or so is whether inflation expectations are rising. At the moment, it looks like they're fairly contained. And that's it. That's a key thing to keep watching over the coming weeks, I think.
Mm-hmm. And so inflation seems to be a key thing here. I mean, with any geopolitical conflict, there seems to be this instinct of flying to safety. How are you viewing traditional safe havens like gold and the US dollar versus things like government bonds?
Yeah, so government bonds have also been subject to quite a repricing over the past week. Bond yields have moved meaningfully higher, and therefore bond prices have moved down. And that's reflecting this inflationary potential shock. And it's also reflecting the implications for policymakers. At the start of this year, we expected the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England to continue to cut interest rates throughout this year. That's now a little bit less clear. And so government bonds suddenly don't look so attractive and have endured a period of volatility. So when we think about this more structurally, how to build a portfolio around safe havens and ensure they are the overall portfolio is robust in these periods, I think what is important is to have a range of safe havens. So government bonds can work very well if there is more of a disinflationary shock, such as during the pandemic. But we've seen gold, commodities, and the US dollar acting more favorably more recently, and particularly when we see more of an inflationary shock to the global economy.
Mm-hmm. And how do other asset classes fare next to these at the moment in your portfolios?
So our philosophy is to focus on long-term real wealth preservation and growth. And at the core of that, of course, is equities, and that's across public and private markets. Equities have, of course, been volatile recently, but that comes off a period of strong momentum. And our outlook continues to be relatively constructive, particularly if we experience a relatively short-lived conflict that means that the volatility that we're seeing within energy markets can stabilize over the coming period. I think there's likely to be the opportunity that comes out of this for a number of quality companies to emerge at much more attractive valuations, and that puts them in a good position to continue to perform well over time.
Mm-hmm. So an opportunity there, perhaps. I mean, it's worth, so you've mentioned a few times this kind of long-term approach. It's worth, I think, touching on that Stone Age Fleming's mandate is often multi-generational. How does that, you know, kind of looking ahead to a 50-year time horizon maybe, impact your day-to-day work compared to maybe a traditional mandate that might be more reactive shorter term?
I think the key thing is to think about how, is to try and separate the day-to-day noise from structural changes in global markets and the global economy. I think a good example of this is artificial intelligence. And so this is where we spend a lot of time focusing and integrating our portfolio positioning. So AI, of course, has been a meaningful driver of markets over the past 2 to 3 years, particularly since the release of ChatGPT at the end of 2022. And the vast majority of those rewards have accrued to those large US technology businesses, the hyperscalers who are investing hundreds of billions of dollars into data centers and AI infrastructure. Now, what's changing now is we're seeing a lot more of a discerning view taken by investors, and companies that are actually investing significantly, particularly through debt financing, are not being rewarded in the same way. So we're seeing a broadening of the AI story to include those companies that are adopting the technology and potentially seeing their profitability and potential earnings growth enhanced over time. So those are the kinds of things that we're spending more time thinking about, is how is these big structural drivers of growth likely to drive different pockets of the equity market over the long term, and how should we position the portfolio around that? And when we do have these shorter term periods of volatility, then we can potentially lean into those areas that we're more constructive on for the longer term.
Mm-hmm. And how difficult is it to separate that noise? Because it's, you know, it seems to be a constant, especially around things like AI, but with any geopolitical conflict. How do you separate that from meaningful structural change? What's the process there?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is challenging, and particularly in the modern age where there's so much information and so much change on almost a day-to-day basis. The key thing is to have a very disciplined and clearly defined framework. And we're very privileged in having a very long history at Stonehage Fleming of managing family wealth over generations. We've all been through these kind of episodes of volatility before. And this current period of geopolitical stress, it has the potential to be the third supply chain shock of the 2020s. So it's not a new feeling to experience this kind of short-term disruption and uncertainty. The key thing is that we reassess and refocus on those long-term principles, and that can keep us honest to the way in which we intend to manage money for clients.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've made it clear that, I suppose, despite this initial shock, mm-hmm. it's perhaps too early, and there's a lot of uncertainty to be making major changes to portfolios. What are the specific indicators, I suppose, besides a change in energy prices, that would signal to you that it's time to actively step in and rebalance?
Yeah, so I think where the crisis itself is concerned, whilst, of course, we can't know how this plays out, it seems likely that there are two potential paths. One is that the conflict is a short-lived one, and we do see President Trump stepping back from the hostilities relatively soon. There has been some indication that could be coming. One of the things we'll be watching closely is how and when that happens, and how do the Iranians respond to that? Importantly, do we start to see the flow of energy through the Strait of Hormuz, which has been so pivotal in this particular crisis? And therefore, how do market participants respond to that? And I think if we see that, then that can give us a little bit more confidence that there's a stabilization taking shape, and markets can start to recover. But importantly, again, it's all in the context of what we're aiming to achieve longer term, and looking for opportunities to rebalance rather than taking sizable asset allocation adjustments.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, noise such as this is one thing for your team and people who are kind of dealing with the day-to-day, and perhaps another one for clients. So how much concern have you seen from your clients regarding the most recent conflict? And how do you reassure them when it all seems to be doom and gloom in the headlines?
Yeah, I think an important thing is communication with our clients. We're very privileged in that our client directors have a relatively small number of families and clients that they look after. And so that level of communication can be very proactive and to a very high level. Just over the last week, I've been involved in a number of discussions with our clients, and the conversation is very familiar. It's along the lines that a number of the concepts that we've spoken about today, focusing on the long-term principles of our investment strategy. So it's all about ensuring that we're reassuring clients that we're there and we can help with any particular concerns that they have.
Mm-hmm. So that trust, I suppose. I mean, yeah. I was interested to see on your website, it said that an entrepreneur's view of risk is often different from a professional investment manager. So how do you and your team bridge that psychological gap, I suppose, in big market movements, but also slightly aside from that, just in day-to-day investments?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. And a lot of our clients are successful entrepreneurs. And as you mentioned, they take a slightly different perspective on risk and what's important to them over the long term. So a key part of our business is working with our clients individually and understanding that each client family is different and their approach to investing is different. And the key thing there is that if you are taking a very long-term horizon, market volatility on a day-to-day or month-to-month basis measured by standard deviation, which is very common in the wealth management industry, of course, is less important than the realization of losses and of course, failing to keep up with inflation, which is a key objective for the majority of our clients.
Mm-hmm. Peter, let's pivot slightly because I'd like to explore your strategy in a bit more detail on the way you actually run your portfolios. So it's probably firstly worth touching on the quite distinctive Stone Age Fleming ecosystem. So you're a multifamily office offering fiduciary, legal, and wealth planning services. So how does your specific investment function integrate with these kind of wider divisions?
Well, it's very collaborative. So as you mentioned, we have a very broad range of services. As a multifamily office, we put our families at the center of those services. So very much depending on their situation and their objectives, we're able to structure and adapt the access to different experts and different services within the business around them. Sometimes that doesn't involve investment management at all. It can focus in on the structuring of wealth, engaging with the next generation, all of those things that you mentioned. But of course, investment management is central to our offering, and it acts as in collaboration with those services. So we're able to offer to our clients a complete range of services, and importantly, the investment philosophy that's embedded within our investment management services is aligned with those long-term perspectives that they're taking.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the next generation in that. I wonder, we hear about the intergenerational wealth transfer so often.
Yes.
But from an investment perspective, how often are you seeing maybe competing priorities with things like ESG, I suppose, and impact investing?
Yes, it's a really interesting one because we have seen over recent years an increased level of engagement and interest from the younger generations in sustainable investing. And the important thing is to recognize that sustainability means different things to different clients, and a portfolio should therefore be built to integrate those interests. So we have a dedicated sustainability offering, which often sits alongside a core strategy. Another thing that's important is that ESG considerations are integrated into the way in which we approach third-party manager research and selection. So over time, it's become an integrated part of manager research and therefore is accessed by the majority of our clients.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about that actually, because obviously your multi-asset solutions rely heavily on third-party managers alongside passive strategies. What makes an active manager truly best in class to make it onto one of your portfolios?
So there's a number of key things that we're looking for within our active manager component of multi-asset portfolios. Importantly, we want to see differentiation from active managers. So firstly, that comes from the shape of the portfolio. We want to see a high degree of active participation in the markets. And often that can be through a relatively focused portfolio of companies. We also want to see that there's a high level of process edge, if you like. So the way in which they approach the selection of companies and the way in which they manage their portfolios has a particular edge over the broader market that we think can sustain long-term outperformance. The other thing that's very important to us is the separation of manager skill from luck. And of course, it's quite easy to review long-term historic performance and identify those managers that have outperformed over time. What's harder to do is to identify why they've outperformed and to ensure that that's something that's repeatable and can be sustained in the future. So we spend a lot of time looking at what's driven historical performance, why managers made certain decisions that they did, and why did those decisions go on to be successful or unsuccessful. And there's a lot of quantitative analysis that takes place there using sophisticated software, but also really getting to know the manager over a period of time before we commit capital. And ultimately, we're aiming to partner with these active managers over the long term.
And crucially, I mean, from a fees perspective, how do you justify the active management premium to clients so they don't feel kind of squeezed by those layered fees?
Yeah, I think it is all about that differentiation within the portfolio to ensure that the portfolio that you are offering through an active manager is truly active and not simply another form of the index. And the other thing that's important is to get the balance right between different styles of active manager and also passives, which you mentioned. And we do believe have an important role in portfolio construction, since they can offer access to broad market cap indices, where you often do find a high degree of market momentum towards the top of the market. Certainly, we've seen that in the US over recent years. So a lot of time is spent both on the analysis and selection of managers, but also how they're constructed within a portfolio to get that balance right between different styles, different types of investing.
Mm-hmm. And Stonehenge leads quite heavily onto kind of quality and long-term secular themes. With amid current volatility, are you finding any opportunities in or to buy into long-term themes such as maybe AI or healthcare? I know we mentioned that earlier, maybe at better valuations.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, AI is clearly a dominant theme at the moment. And one aspect of investing which we do think has a lot of opportunity in the coming years is quality investing, which of course can mean different things to different investors. For us, it's all about finding managers that, again, have a repeatable edge within that style of investment management. And over the course of the last year or so, quality as a general style has faced a relative amount of pressure. It wasn't really involved in the very strong recovery we saw in the markets after the Liberation Day tariffs last year. But we've also seen some added pressure this year from AI-related disruption concerns, really focused on the software sector, which is often where quality managers find opportunities. So that means that the portfolio of companies that a lot of quality managers are emphasizing are trading on quite interesting valuations at the moment, and yet their earnings potential is still pretty robust when you do the analysis. So we think quality has the potential to do very well, and healthcare in particular, I think, could be a real beneficiary of AI adoption, both through enhancements to clinical drug trials, improving the positivity there that's achieved, but also there's a lot of inefficiencies within the healthcare space that AI can help to address, and so we're already seeing some evidence of that coming through. And healthcare over the past 6 months or so has been performing rather well. So that's also a key part of our equity portfolio.
We focused, I suppose, mostly on the Middle Eastern conflict today. Mm. By the time this podcast comes out and our listeners will be hearing you, no doubt the markets will have changed again and yes. There'll be a few other announcements from Trump, I'm sure. But what would you say as a final parting piece of advice to listeners who may be a bit unsure how to respond to the current volatility, unsure about where to invest next?
I think the most important thing is to focus on long-term investment objectives, to stay calm, stay the course, which is almost always the most appropriate course of action, and to ensure the portfolio remains robust and well diversified.
I think that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's all for today. See you next time on The Wealth Show.
Today is VE Day. The boys
are the crowned queen. Waves from the Belt.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has
tearing
landed.
Down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth: cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
And Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.